It's Thursday, March 21st. Texas's controversial immigration law stuck in legal limbo. We start here. A federal appeals court set to decide if Texas can arrest and deport people who are in the state illegally.
This is such a recipe for confusion and chaos, really.
Why what's known as Senate Bill 4 is now back in court after the Supreme Court already weighed in. Are Republicans still trying to impeach President Biden?
What's good for Donald Trump is not necessarily what's good for the Republican Party.
What impeachment hearing theatrics and primaries this week mean for the race for the White House? And a geopolitical falling out.
They are at an impasse, and the president has been much more vocal about it.
The fraying U.S.-Israel relationship as famine closes in on Gaza. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Jay O'Brien. Hey there, I'm filling in for Brad today. We've got a lot of ground to cover, but let's start with the twists and turns, that legal saga over a Texas law that you've been hearing about.
I think it passes constitutional muster. I think it's the right policy for the state of Texas. We have to have a secure border.
There is no money assigned to this bill or the enforcement or the incarceration.
People of color are not going to feel safe going out into the streets, especially those who come from immigrant communities.
We're talking about SB 4, Senate Bill 4, that controversial immigration law in Texas that allows state and local authorities to arrest people suspected of being undocumented immigrants.
And it was set to go into effect earlier this month, but several civil rights groups and the Department of Justice sued the state.
It's ping-ponged around the court system from the Supreme Court earlier this week to a federal appeals court yesterday, all because this law really ignites one central legal question. Does a state have the right to enforce its own immigration policies, or is that something that only the federal government can do? For decades, it's been the latter, but Texas is trying to change that.
Texas has a right to defend ourselves, and we will use that authority to declare an invasion and fight back against that invasion.
Let's bring in ABC News senior national correspondent Terry Moran, now sitting right across from me. And Terry, give me a sense of the legal developments here. It has been hard to follow. This has been in and out of court for different reasons. What is the most recent thing that has happened, and how did we get here?
Well, the most recent thing that has happened is that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the United States Appeals Court, yesterday held a hearing in which they decided what should happen to this law. Now, that confused people, because everybody saw the headline earlier in the week, Supreme Court lets the law go into effect.
Nothing goes from the Supreme Court, or usually doesn't go from the Supreme Court back to an appellate court
and
unless they send it back.
Right, yeah. And so how did that happen? Well, the Supreme Court's letting it go into effect was really a push for that Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to clean up their act. They'd been sitting on the case for a while. Justice Amy Coney Barrett actually wrote this when the Supreme Court allowed the law to go in effect. And what she said was, we don't want to get in the business of running the schedule and the administrative work. In other words, when are you going to decide this? She said, but you've had it long enough. So it was a shocking way of encouraging the judges down in Texas to get their act together. And sure enough, they did. Just a few hours later, they went the other way and they said, okay, we're gonna have this hearing tomorrow, and we're blocking the law from going into effect while we do this.
It's not like this hasn't been nationally known and getting headlines all the time, and something that is a complex legal question. Can the federal government regulate immigration versus a state? I'll get into that with you in a second. But first, what happened in that hearing yesterday in the federal appeals court?
Yeah, it was fascinating to listen to. So the lawyers had, you know, a few hours to prepare. It was 10 a.m. They had the decision to have the hearing and to block the law from going into effect pending that hearing. It's a three-judge panel. And you could feel the split.
I'm not sure I understand the law totally.
One of the judges was very skeptical of Texas. She was very harsh on Texas. How can Texas do this given Supreme Court precedent and the constitutional structure, which allows the federal government so much authority over international affairs, including the registration and immigration of people coming to the country?
This is the first time, it seems to me, that a state has claimed that they have the right to remove illegal aliens.
Another judge who had been a general counsel to Texas Governor Greg Abbott, was the other way, very skeptical of the federal government's position.
We have no clue how any of this would actually be enforced because there's not been a single person who's been arrested, not a single person who's been ordered removed, not a single state judge who's had occasion to adjudicate a single provision of this in any way. So we're predicting all of this, right? And we have to say all of it is unlawful, and therefore the entire thing will never go into effect, so saith the federal court.
And the other judge was quiet. But she's a Biden appointee. So if you're a betting man, you would say that this panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit will not let this law go into effect. That's probably what's going to happen. And it will go upstairs once again to the Supreme Court of the United States, which will have to have the final word.
And just for the folks at home playing, you know, lawyers with headphones on here as they listen to this, what we're talking about here is preventing the law from going into effect while the larger legal case about this law's constitutionality plays out. Is that correct?
Right. And that's really the important issue.
Yeah. That's what we're fighting over right now.
They're going to get, all these judges will get down, and in fact, there's a lower court judge, a district court judge, that did. They're going to get to this constitutional collision. Texas has passed a law that it wants to enforce that essentially defies the law of immigration in this country for 100 years. And a specific Supreme Court precedent that's just 12 years old when Arizona tried to do something similar. And the Supreme Court of the United States said, no, the federal government has full authority over immigration. The states cannot pass their own laws and enforce their own immigration scheme.
So, Terry, we got all of that. But what is Texas's argument for doing this?
The reason Texas is doing this is because the federal government has failed, not just the Biden administration. The Congress has failed, previous administrations. And Texas is a sovereign state. The states are sovereign. They have responsibility for the safety of their people, for the prosperity of their people as well. And so under that, Texas reasons and some specific clauses of the Constitution that they argue empowers them to take action if the federal government is failing. The Supreme Court will take note of the crisis on the border and say, you know, we don't blame them. The question is, has Texas gone too far? But this is such a recipe for confusion and chaos, really. If every single state, imagine Gavin Newsom saying, okay, we're going to have our own immigration law. Imagine a person who is lawfully present in Arizona. This example was raised in the hearing yesterday and has a hearing for asylum in 2 years in Arizona. In Texas, that person could be arrested and deported. What if they go across the border for, you know, to on vacation or whatever? They can be arrested in Texas, but are okay to live in Arizona, to say nothing of the impact on foreign relations, which is exclusively the province of the federal government. It's a bold move by Texas, probably doomed, but understandable, and will find sympathetic hearing in the Supreme Court.
Terry Moran, always breaking down some of the most complex stuff for us. Terry, thank you, sir.
You bet, Jay.
Next up on Start Here, what's a congressional hearing without a Vladimir Putin mask? We'll be back in a bit.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We all know politics can get a little theatrical at times, and that's what happened yesterday on Capitol Hill in the latest hearing of the House Republican-led impeachment inquiry into President Biden.
I just came to thank James Comer for taking all of our intelligence and using it in the committee.
One Democrat, Jared Moskowitz of Florida, walked into the hearing wearing a rubber mask of Vladimir Putin's face, as a way to say, in his view, Republicans were peddling Russian misinformation about the president and his son, Hunter. And then all throughout the proceedings, we saw these heated exchanges between lawmakers and witnesses.
It is simple. You name the crime. Did you watch him steal something?
Corruption statutes, RICO and conspiracy.
What is it? What is the crime, sir?
Now, House Republicans are calling these proceedings a win, pointing to the fact that in the hearing, two former associates of Hunter Biden testified that they believe President Biden was involved in his son's overseas business dealings. But Democrats quickly pointed out that neither of those witnesses provided any evidence of those claims. In fact, after months of this impeachment inquiry, House Republicans haven't been able to provide any conclusive proof that President Biden benefited from his son's business dealings. So with all of that in mind, we have a treat for you. I am here in the same room of our Washington, D.C. bureau with ABC News political director Rick Klein. There is nothing I like more than being in the same room as Rick Klein and talking about politics. So, Rick, you saw a little bit of what played out in the House. Where do you see this Republican impeachment inquiry going anywhere? Do they have the votes right now to pass articles on the floor if they wanted to?
Yeah, that's a flat no, Jay. If they had the votes, they probably would have done it already.
Yeah.
Because they obviously the base wants it. A lot of them are promising their constituents that that's where this inquiry is going to lead. It would make a lot of sense. They don't have the votes. In fact, they're losing another vote at the end of the week with Congressman Ken Buck leaving. So they have the barest of majorities. They have not produced any evidence to date that advances the conversation and shows an impeachable offense. They haven't convinced the public. All of the big blockbuster hearings have turned into either busts or farces. So at this point, the name of the game is off-ramps. What can they do short of impeachment? Because they have promised these huge revelations. So if they don't have that, do they refer something to the Department of Justice? Do they try to pass a bill that would limit some of the activities that they say they believe Hunter Biden engaged in or his father engaged in that were inappropriate or even illegal? Do they find some way to say, yeah, we're listening and we're getting this done? So they just keep it kind of lingering all the way through November, because it is pretty clear now they are never going to vote to impeach Joe Biden.
It's interesting. That's kind of what I wanted to ask you, was do you see a world in which this could linger all the way until November, despite the fact that you've got two competing forces, right? The base wants you to do something now. The moderates don't want you to do anything at all. And leadership, as I've seen in my reporting too, is just kind of caught in the middle.
Yeah. And these inquiries kind of take on a life of their own. And you get to a point where it's impossible to imagine James Comer, Jim Jordan, Matt Gaetz saying, you know what? There was nothing there. Never mind. Case closed.
Yeah, never going to happen.
Never going to happen. It looks like he'd be fully exonerated. And that's not what Republicans believe they have, even if they don't have impeachable offenses. So I don't see a situation where this is kind of wrapped up in a bow. But I do think they are going to look for ways to kind of present it to the public as saying, look, we put our best case forward. Here it is. Even though there will not almost certainly be a vote on the House floor.
You and I could talk about this forever. But I want to pivot to something else, because we also saw another round of primaries this week. You're our professional tea leaf reader in a way. Is there anything that you saw in those primaries, while we know who the candidates are, it could be instructive to the general election in November?
Yeah, I mean, look, what's good for Donald Trump is not necessarily what's good for the Republican Party. We saw that in Ohio in this Senate race. When you put forward a candidate who has as many potential flaws and vulnerabilities as Bernie Moreno, you stick by him and you get him over the top by a lot. He won by almost 20 points in a crowded field. Big victory for Donald Trump. Big victory for MAGA. But are Republicans happy about that? It was Democrats who were looking to get Bernie Moreno to win that Senate nomination in Ohio. It gives them maybe a better shot to save the Senate with Sherrod Brown and his seat. And I think when you look across the states that have voted, now we're two full weeks after Nikki Haley dropped out, and you're still getting 15, 20 plus percentage points votes for Nikki Haley or for other Republicans. Now, there's similar numbers that are emerging on the Democratic side. A lot of skepticism for him as well. But the fact that there's still so many Republican voters that are primary voters that are voting against Donald Trump tells you about the limitations that Donald Trump has. So both things can be true. You could be looking at this and saying he is as strong as ever inside the Republican Party, but actually, he's got some problems inside his own Republican Party, too.
So what you're seeing in those Nikki Haley votes is that is a protest vote in what you're saying that could demonstrate that these voters will never come back into the fold for Donald Trump.
Yeah, and we saw that with exit polls in Ohio, and we've seen it across a series of states. Haley voters are very likely to say they may not vote at all, or they may vote for someone other than Donald Trump. Some 30% thereabouts, about a third of Republican voters across these states are saying, you know, if he's convicted of a crime, that might not make him fit for office, yeah. or that they're just dissatisfied with the choice. And yeah, some of the votes that are rolling in now came in before Haley dropped out when there was still a competitive primary because of early voting. But there is some number that's still actively voting for essentially zombie campaigns. Even though Donald Trump has won the nomination, they are showing up and voting. They're sending in ballots for someone else, knowing that the nominee is going to be Donald Trump.
I think back to Michigan when we had that uncommitted protest yeah. vote against President Biden over the Israel-Hamas war. And the Biden campaign's messaging from that night on was, we hear you. We're going to try to make overtures. We believe with those overtures, you'll come back into the Democratic fold. The Trump campaign is not doing that messaging when it comes to Haley voters, are they?
They've never done that messaging when it comes to anyone. It's been, this is the Trump train, and it's going to roll over you. We saw that with Ron DeSantis this week saying, someone that you've covered over the years, Jay, saying that that he's not sure he's going to campaign for Donald Trump. And the Trump campaign saying back, we don't want him anyway, because we want to win this thing. They've never done the kind of healing thing that typically happens. And it's worked for him so far. More people than not on the Republican side are getting on board. And look, Biden is going to have to worry about his own base, because it wasn't just Michigan. We saw it in Minnesota. We saw it again in Ohio. We saw it in Arizona. There's a quantity of voters out there, even knowing that President Biden is going to be the nominee again, are still saying, wait a second, we want to send a message. We're not thrilled with this, whether that's voting for another candidate or voting for something, quote unquote, uncommitted.
Rick Klein, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
The U.S. is Israel's strongest ally. On the world stage, it's sometimes compared to Israel's older brother. But as Israel has continued its offensive in Gaza after the October 7th terror attack by Hamas, there have been serious signs of daylight between these two countries.
We've been clear about the need to prioritize the protection of civilians.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed Senate Republicans behind closed doors yesterday. That meeting was a way of hitting back at the Senate's top Democrat and the nation's most senior Jewish elected official, Chuck Schumer, who last week gave a speech that called for new elections in Israel and branded Netanyahu as an obstacle to peace.
It has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th.
And all of this comes as the Israeli leader seems poised to defy warnings from the Biden administration and mount an offensive into Rafah, a region in the south of Gaza where an estimated 1.7 million Palestinians have sought refuge. ABC's Matt Gutman is following it all for us from Israel. Matt, Republicans in D.C., as you know, they have rallied to the Israeli prime minister's defense after those comments from Chuck Schumer. House Speaker Mike Johnson even said yesterday he's considering inviting Netanyahu to address Congress. It's all politically complicated, but is this indicative of a bigger problem, do you think, of Israel and U.S. relations? Have they frayed in recent months?
I think they certainly have. You know, the U.S. is rather accustomed to, when it says something and it lays down the law, as the president has, hey, I consider this a bad idea. It would be a mistake to go into Rafah to launch this offensive into a very small area in the south of the Gaza Strip where 1.5 million Palestinians are seeking shelter. Many of them have been displaced more than once already because of this war. And you're going to launch a major offensive to try to root out the five remaining Hamas battalions? No, I think this is a bad idea. Don't do it. And Israel says again and again, no, we're going to do it.
Those who say that under no circumstances should we enter Rafah are basically saying, lose the war.
We don't care about the relationship. This is paramount for us. They are at an impasse.
The president has rejected the straw man that raising questions about Rafah is the same as raising questions about defeating Hamas.
And the president has been much more vocal about it. And, you know, typically in years past, you might not have heard the president call Senate Majority Leader Schumer's speech a good speech, but he did.
He made a good speech, and I think he expressed a serious concern shared not only by him, but by many Americans.
Essentially endorsing it, and that's a big deal. And I think both sides are now trying to come back off that limb, right? Israel sending a really high-profile delegation to Washington, comprising three of the five members of the war cabinet. That's a big deal. And of course, Secretary Blinken is coming here on Friday. So they are trying to work this out to find an alternative approach to the Rafah offensive. It's unclear if Israel's already decided because Netanyahu said, yeah, I've approved the plan. We don't know what it is. The IDF still isn't quite sure. It doesn't sound like it has, from my conversation with his chief spokesman, a really great idea of how they're going to move everybody out. But they say they're going to do it.
I want to dig into that a little bit more, actually. What is their thinking into why they feel they have to do this offensive now?
Netanyahu has been promising Israelis total victory. Everybody knows that's not possible. Everybody knows they can't kill every last Hamas militant and official in Gaza. Israel believes at this point that there were 40,000 Hamas fighters. They think about 26,000 have been killed, captured, or wounded. So they have maybe 14,000 left. They think they can get half of them in this Rafah offensive. Five full intact Hamas battalions are in Rafah. Senior Israeli official telling me he also wants to see Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas's head, on a pike.
A path to peace that makes Israel so weak and unable to defend itself, and our neighbors still adhering to the goal of destroying the Jewish state, then obviously we will set peace backward and not forward.
They want to get those guys, and unless they can do that and at least say, hey, listen, we have dismantled Hamas as a militarily capable fighting army, right? That's what it was. Now it's just a guerrilla group that's in disarray and with no real leadership, and, you know, we'll fight it and stamp it out as much as we can. But we've killed the army. We've delivered you success. That's it. If they don't go into Rafah, they cannot say that. Netanyahu loses. He backs out on his promise to the nation, and this is what Israelis expect. And I think one of the things that we don't see, and that I'm surprised at each time I come back here, is the degree to which the trauma from October 7th remains and the fear that it might happen again. So Israelis are, by a very large majority, supportive of this Rafah offensive, despite the fact that the U.S. and the NGOs and the U.N. are vehemently opposed to it.
All of this is playing out, obviously, in the midst of that serious humanitarian crisis in Gaza, the UN warning that famine is imminent. We know the U.S. wants to use a maritime corridor, as we've heard it so often called, to try to get more aid in. What is your understanding of how long that's going to take to be up and running?
So they're called JLOTs. There are two U.S. military ships headed this way, 500 soldiers on each of them, and they're going to build a temporary but pretty solid 1,800-foot pier off the coast of Gaza.
When established, this corridor will enable the distribution of up to 2 million meals every single day, as well as medicine, water, and other critical humanitarian supplies.
It's going to take them time. It's going to take 6 weeks for them just to start really building it, and it'll take 8 weeks for it to be operational. The people who are starving in northern Gaza right now are starting to die in significant numbers, according to the UN.
Children are dying of malnutrition. They are dying of dehydration. Horrendous ways for a child to die. The only way is to get that aid through on the roads. And
they need aid right now. And the only way a significant amount of aid can get in to actually help these people is by land through Israel. Israel today and over the past week has been insisting it is trying to flood the Gaza Strip with aid. It's opening up multiple ports of entry. The issue is distribution. The NGOs, including the UN, say, hey, listen, Israel's right. We are not doing a great job distributing this aid, getting it to the people who need it most, because we can't get to these areas. It's too dangerous. There's ongoing fighting. Israel's been striking either near or at some of these convoys, and we just can't send our people to do that. They also have logistical issues. They say they can't provide the aid to the people who are starving right now unless there's a ceasefire. And hey, here's the catch-22. Ceasefire's not coming either. Both sides are dragging their feet in the hostage negotiations. A delegation that Israel just sent to Doha 2 days ago has come back. This is going to take weeks. There's not going to be a ceasefire, likely until after the offensive in Rafah. Who knows how long that's going to be? So the NGOs are completely justified in being terrified about the humanitarian fallout that is about to happen. And if it's bad right now, 6 weeks from now, it's going to be tragic, Jay.
The humanitarian fallout. Matt Gutman, trekking it all for us in Israel. Matt, thank you.
Thanks, Jay.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, so long to the original Short King. One last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan.
It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Washington, D.C. is not a sentimental town. Take it from me. I live here. But Washingtonians have come to love this little withered cherry blossom tree of only a few branches. He's named Stumpy because he's shorter than the rest, often compared to a kind of tree version of a short king. He was a symbol for a lot of people of resilience during the pandemic.
It is a stump, but look, there's cherry blossoms growing out of it.
A little worn, Stumpy has bloomed every year without fail, including this one, but not next year.
Stumpy is a climate change story. His appearance is due to climate change, and the only way we can fix the problem caused by that climate change is to repair the seawall.
The National Park Service says Stumpy and more than 150 of his cherry blossom brothers and sisters will be chopped down for a project to raise nearby seawalls because of rising tides due to climate change. Since that announcement, hundreds have come to pay their respects to Stumpy. A trumpeter from the National Symphony Orchestra played a tribute. One person left a bottle of whiskey at Stumpy's roots. Others are going up and just hugging the tree.
Well, I'm going to take a photo of Stumpy.
Yes.
So that I will always have Stumpy.
Some people are genuinely upset, posting the hashtag SaveStumpy on social media, calling for the tree and others to be saved and replanted somewhere else. That doesn't look likely, but there is some good news. Stumpy's seeds will be scattered, officials say, and his saplings will dot the tidal basin for years to come. And he's taught us a valuable lesson. Never be ashamed of what you find inspiration from. A song, a speech, and a movie. And yes, Stumpy. I hope you find inspiration from us, too. Thanks for hanging with us today. You can get more of these stories on abcnews.com and the ABC News app. I'm Jay O'Brien, in for Brad Milkey. We'll see you next time.